Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. This hour we are talking politics. It is primary day in five states, including big ones in Arizona and in Florida. We're still talking about that New York City mosque, Barack Obama's Christianity, and the millions of Americans who are still unemployed as they prepare to cast their ballots this fall. Here in Ohio, we can start casting ballots for governor and other races in just about a month. Joining us this hour, NPR's political editor, the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, five states, Alaska, Arizona, Florida, Oklahoma, and my personal favorite, Vermont, are holding primaries today. Which one intrigues you the most?
Clearly Vermont, because I have no idea why that's your personal favorite. There are some great races, clearly. Arizona and Alaska and Florida, all of them. But I like Alaska and Arizona, especially because everybody was looking at this year as perhaps the end of John McCain's career. The conservatives never liked him. They never trusted him. And with an anti-establishment year and the fact that the Tea Party has risen to some heights in certain states, a lot of people thought that maybe John McCain would be on his way out. Also in Alaska, home of Sarah Palin, or at least the temporary home of Sarah Palin until she quit her governorship, but she is backing a challenger to Lisa Murkowski in today's Senate race there with also Tea Party support. And so at one point, it was going to be interesting to see if McCain and Murkowski, the two Macs, and Mac and Merck, were going to survive their primary challenge. It looks like they will.
Now, Sarah Palin supported Joe Miller, the challenger to Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, and she also supported John McCain, but her support of McCain, whether it's having an impact or not, it remains in question. But McCain seems to be doing better than Joe Miller in Alaska.
Yeah, I think the Sarah Palin endorsement of McCain in Arizona is more perfunctory than anything else. Of course, John McCain is the person who created Sarah Palin as a national political force. But, of course, it's the Tea Party backing J.D. Hayworth, a former congressman, a very conservative congressman, especially on issues of illegal immigration. But, look, John McCain has been very conservative on this issue as well. Once upon a time, he was backing, worker programs, and a lot of people said he was for amnesty, and now he has these ads saying we have to complete the dang fence. He's going to out Hayworth when it comes to illegal immigration. And given what happened with the Prop 1070 in Arizona, the controversial law that Governor Jan Brewer signed into law, although it's been mostly redacted from the courts, McCain has taken a very popular position in the state. He's also spent $20 million.
Yes, that always helps. 292-8513. If you have a question for Ken Rudin, the political junkie from National Public Radio, I guess it's just NPR now, 292-8513, or you can email a question to allsides@wosu.org. Ken, has there been any blowback because John McCain has truly changed positions? You could say he's tacked to the right. He's basically taken a hard right in many of these issues. But he's getting away with it looks like, or at least it's not a big deal to Arizona Republicans.
Well, everybody does what they have to do to get reelected or elected, and sometimes it moves if it means moving far to the left or far to the right or far to the center, whatever the center is anymore. Mm-hmm. People do that. Now, there are a lot of people in the media who once had this love affair with John McCain, especially in 2000 when he was the Maverick Express. He was really, and of course, he was running against the Republican establishment in George W. Bush in the 2000 Republican primaries. So the media had this love affair with John McCain. They lost a lot of that in 2008 when McCain was the Republican nominee for president against Barack Obama. And, as he's moved even further and further to the right to hold off this anti-illegal immigration Tea Party challenge from the right with John D. Hayworth, McCain has gotten some criticism. People are saying, what about his legacy? What does he stand for? What will he be best remembered for? And John McCain is 73 years old. He didn't want what happened to Arlen Specter to happen to him, in that voters just suddenly got tired of him and he just voted out of office. Same with Robert Bennett in Utah, who was lost nomination because he wasn't deemed conservative enough. John McCain said, look, I got to do what I got to do. And he did what he had to do.
Speaking of doing what he had to do, Ken alluded to briefly the negative ads that have been running in this campaign. $21 million John McCain has spent in his race against J.D. Hayworth. Here's an example of one of those ads.
When word got out that J.D. Hayworth starred in an infomercial for a shady company promoting free government money, Hayworth's response was,
yeah, I appeared in this. One of the staples I learned growing up is caveat emptor. Buyer beware. buyer beware, buyer beware.
J.D. Hayworth, pork barrel spender, lobbyist, huckster, voter beware.
I'm John McCain, and I approve this message.
Notice the change in music there. What you can't hear on the radio, Ken, or you can't see on the radio, obviously, is that you keep seeing in big capital letters, buyer beware, buyer beware, buyer beware. That's not a very statesmanlike ad for Senator McCain.
No. And of course, the right wing, the Tea Party folks were throwing everything they can at John McCain for years as well. They called him, you know, supportive of amnesty. They thought he betrayed President Bush's conservative philosophy on tax cuts, on immigration, on a whole assortment of things. So conservatives have not been happy with McCain from the beginning. But again, McCain could never out-conservative J.D. Hayworth. He was one of the most stalwarts of the 1994 Gingrich Revolution. Very, very conservative. But if you could ask questions about his character, and J.D. Hayworth, of course, got a lot of money from Jack Abramoff, one of the reasons why Hayworth lost his 2006 re-election battle for Congress, and the fact that he did this infomercial, that's why he calls him J.D. Huckster, mm-hmm. where he's talking about how you can get money from the government and with no risk and no risk. It just looked kind of awful. So I think ideology took a backseat in McCain's efforts to outperform Hayworth, but running more on character.
Mm-hmm. 292-8513, if you'd like to speak with Ken Rudin, the NPR political junkie. He joins us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. Ken, why is John McCain running for re-election? He's 73 years old, as you mentioned. He ran for president. He won his party nomination. He's accomplished a lot in his political career, not to mention his military career before that. Why do these guys keep running and stick around? We just saw Byrd pass away, and Ted Kennedy was in his 70s.
McCain is 73. Robert Byrd was still running. He would have kept running in 2012 had he survived. Strom Thurmond kept running in 96. Basically, it's their whole life. I mean, John McCain first elected to Congress in 1982. He's really done nothing else. And I think a lot of it is redemption. I think he was embarrassed by the campaign of 2008. A lot of criticism about his picking of Sarah Palin, about his tactics or lack of tactics, the fact that he lost a lot of solidly Republican states like Indiana, North Carolina, Virginia, states that have long gone Republican Party to the Republican Party but lost to Obama. And I think he just, wanted to just say, look, I'm not finished and I have a lot of work to be done. And maybe even if I'm not going to be president, I can be part of the opposition and a strong opponent of President Obama, which he has become.
Let's move east along the Sun Belt to Florida. Charlie Crist not seeking re-election for governor. That has set up a battle on the Republican side for governor. But he is going to seek re-election, but as an independent. He's not seeking the nomination on the GOP side.
Well, he's not seeking re-election because he's no longer running for governor.
He's running for Senate. That's right.
One thing before we leave Arizona, Dan Quayle's son, in a congressional race in the 3rd congressional district around Phoenix and Paradise Valley, Ben Quayle is running his first campaign. He already has a commercial out calling President Obama the worst president in history. And it just kind of, he's making a lot of the same mistakes. Everybody talked about how gaffe-prone Dan Quayle was. It'd be very interesting to see if Ben Quayle can survive his primary because he's getting a lot of ridicule for tactics he's doing in Arizona. Okay, back to Florida.
Well, also, he's getting some criticism for some blogging he did for the website DirtyScottsdale.com.
DirtyScottsdale.com, which sadly my subscription has just run out, so I didn't see all of
it. Well, it's changed to Dirty.com now.
Yeah. Well, it's basically about the raunchy side of Scottsdale's nightlife, and Ben Quayle, this is way, way back in 2007.
Yeah, way
so,
back.
Of course, that's a long, long time ago, when we were just kids back then, probably a youthful indiscretion. So anyway, he denied writing about it, and then he said, well, yes, I did do it, but I didn't write the kind of stuff people say I did, but then he did admit to it. So it's one of those things where you know if you're a relative of Dan Quayle, you're going to get scrutiny. You know that everything is going to be under a tremendous microscope, and Ben Quayle should have known better. Mm-hmm. But again, he's one of like five or six candidates in the solidly Republican district. Whoever wins the primary there today will be the next congressperson.
Who knew all those retirees in Scottsdale could be taking part in such a such a raunchy website, you know, in nightlife.
Exactly. Okay, moving to Florida.
Yes.
So anyway, for the longest time, we all kept talking about the Republican primary for the Senate. This is the one that Mel Martinez gave up, and he resigned. And so Charlie Crist, the governor, wanted this from the beginning and was assumed to be the next Republican nominee, if not the next senator from Florida. But then Marco Rubio, who was an early Tea Party candidate, even before there was a Tea Party, very conservative, pointed out the fact that Charlie Crist made the terrible mistake of embracing President Obama when Obama came down to Florida to push for his stimulus program. So Rubio was doing so well with conservative and Republican voters that Charlie Crist decided to leave the GOP because he was not going to win the primary, just like Arlen Specter was not going to win the Republican Party in Pennsylvania. As it turned out, he wasn't going to win the Democratic primary either. So now all the attention is now on the Democratic side. And you have Kendrick Meek, who's an African-American congressman from Miami. His mother served in Congress, and he was presumed to be the clear front-runner for the Democratic nomination. But along came this guy named Jeff Green, a billionaire who made most of his money on foreclosures and things like that. And, he's a real estate mogul, and he's pointing poured in tens of millions of dollars in a late campaign to say that Kendrick Meek is just not, you know, a good enough candidate to run statewide. For some time, it looked like Jeff Green was making headway, but Bill Clinton campaigned for Kendrick Meek. Obama has run some ads for him, and it looks like Meek will win the nomination. But ironically, it looks like whoever wins the Democratic nomination will finish in third place in Florida. Mm-hmm. The winner will either be Rubio, the Republican, or Crist, the independent.
Who is better for Charlie Crist? Is it Meek or Green?
I think it would be Green, and I'll tell you why. Because Green has been really stepping on a lot of toes in the Democratic establishment. I think there are a lot of Democratic Party stalwarts that if Jeff Green wins the nomination, a lot of them say, you know, I don't like this, I'm going to stick with Charlie Crist. Mm-hmm. But again, if Meek being African-American, backed by Obama, backed by Clinton, I think that he may corral many of the African-American voters who would ordinarily have gone to Charlie Crist in November. So if Meek wins the nomination, as it looks like it'll happen, it looks like Marco Rubio will be, we keep talking about Tea Party people like Sharon Angle in Nevada and Rand Paul in Kentucky. But Marco Rubio, one of the original Tea Party candidates, could win that Senate race in Florida.
Ken, what do you make of an August 24th primary? I mean, this is the dog days of August. I mean, is it intentional on these states' part to have their primary at this point in the summer? We had a primary a couple of weeks ago, too, in August.
Well, it's always been that. I mean, you know, obviously it goes according to calendar. Yeah. But Florida, these states, Washington State, Wyoming, they've always had late Florida primaries, late August primaries. Yeah. And, of course, the turnout will never be as good as it would be in, like, you know, like June or September. Mm-hmm. But that's the way it's always been. In the old days in Florida, there wasn't a Republican Party to even talk about. They didn't have a Republican senator until 68, a Republican governor until 66. Now, while that does seem like a long time ago, but for decades, for a century, you know, for the longest time, it was a solidly Democratic state. I don't think they're doing it to discourage turnout. And, of course, if nobody gets a majority, there is a September runoff, so there would be a larger turnout, the potential for a larger turnout in September. But that's always been the luck of the draw. Florida's always, the legislature for the beginning has always wanted a August primary, and they always had one.
All right. Let's take a break. We're talking with Ken Rudin, the NPR political junkie, on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When we return, we'll look at the Ohio races for governor and U.S. Senate and get a look at some of the other controversies like the mosque controversy and the BP oil spill. Remember that? The political implications of all that coming up when All Sides continues on WOSU.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. At WOSU, listener feedback is very important. Your thoughts on the conversation some of us have been having across the radio and web matter a lot to us. We're creating an online audience advisory panel, and we're looking for at least 1,000 listeners who can help. If you have a moment, please go to wosu.org/survey to sign up and send us your thoughts. That's wosu.org/survey.
Support for WOSU comes from Columbus College of Art and Design. Creative Futures begin in Saturday morning art classes for children and youth starting September 25th. Information and online registration at www.ccad.edu.
71 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly cloudy today, a little bit of sunshine and a high of 82. Partly cloudy tonight and a low of 64 degrees, a slight chance of rain tomorrow and a high of 83. All Sides with Ann Fisher with guest host Mike Thompson continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Our guest, Ken Rudin, NPR political editor and host of the blog Political Junkie. You can catch that at the website npr.org. And also you hear Ken on WOSU each Wednesday on Talk of the Nation as he does his weekly political roundup with Neil Conan. We talked earlier about John McCain, how at age 73 was seeking re-election. George Voinovich, who was in his 70s, decided, no, I'm going to leave Washington, spend more time with my family. And he has set up a pretty competitive race to succeed him by with the competitors being Rob Portman, the Republican, and Lee Fisher, the current lieutenant governor, the Democrat. Portman has a huge lead in money. Ken, the past couple of weeks or so, he seems to be opening up a slight lead in the polls. Are national Democrats still hoping that Lee Fisher can pull this out?
Well, they're certainly hoping. And of course, this race is far from over. It is very close in the polls. But as you say, as you implied, Democrats are very nervous about this seat. This is the one where from the beginning, the race was going to be either you blame Strickland and Fisher for the poor economy in Ohio, or you blame Portman and George W. Bush for the poor economy, because, of course, Portman was the trade representative under President Bush, the budget director, things like that. So, you know, if you want to keep running against Bush in 2010, what better candidate to run against, associate him with, than Rob Portman? But I think Portman is a good candidate. He's always been an attractive candidate, a good, easygoing style. He does have a reputation of reaching across the aisle, working with Democrats. And as you say, he has tons and tons of money. I think he has $7 million more than Lee Fisher, whose campaign we've seen him firing his campaign manager. There's disarray in the camp. Now, of course, you know, August is a long time away from November. It doesn't sound like a lot, but of course, a lot of things can happen. But there seems to be a trend away from the Democrat in this race. The Democrats, of course, know that if the Republicans pick up 10 Senate seats in November, they will reclaim the majority that they lost in 2006. 10 seats is a lot. I don't think they can do it. But of course, if there's any kind of a tsunami, as we saw in 1994, then, you know, if there's a trend, if it's just so bad for the Democrats, then states like even California or Washington or those kind of states could go to the Republican column. Democrats would love to hold Republicans back by winning Voinovich's seat with Lee Fisher. Right now, again, the polls show it even. I suspect Portman does win in November, but you know there's going to be a lot of Democratic money, labor money thrown into the state to help Fisher.
The whole blame Bush strategy, trying to link Rob Portman to George W. Bush, and on a larger scale, other Democrats doing the same thing. Rob Portman told the New York Times in an article published today, he says, the world has moved on. Has the world moved on from George W. Bush, Ken?
Well, Democrats certainly hope not. I mean, for decades they were running against Herbert Hoover. You heard that name being used a long time. But just as Republicans still run against Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. Look, as Rob Portman said in the article that, you know, voters have moved on from that. Apparently, Democrats have not. They need more of an issue. Portman's resume of being part of the George Bush economic team does give the Democrats some ammunition. But right now, you know, I think people are more likely to blame. I know we talk about blame all the time as opposed to credit. But if you're blaming somebody, it looks like they're blaming more Strickland and Obama than you are about George W. Bush in the previous administration. But some Democrats say, look, that's not fair at all. What happened with the collapse, the near collapse of the financial industry and the rising unemployment, that began well before January 20th, 2009, when President Obama took office. And so that will ultimately decide who wins the race in the end.
We're speaking with Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and the political junkie. You hear him Wednesdays on Talk of the Nation. You can also read his blog at npr.org. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann Fisher today on All Sides. Moving to the governor's race, John Kasich, Ted Strickland, John Kasich, the Republican challenger to the Democrat incumbent. How do you look at this race, Ken?
Well, it's almost separate from the it's similar in a way in the fact that they're talking Democrats would love to talk about Kasich's ties to Wall Street and Lehman Brothers and things like that. But it's different. Kasich has been out of the public eye since 2000. The polls still show it very, very close. But I suspect that Strickland is a better candidate than Fisher. I think Kasich is not as good a candidate as Portman. And just as I think that Portman has a slight lead in the Senate race, I think Strickland has a slight lead in the gubernatorial race. And, of course, Strickland has much more money than Kasich in this race. So perhaps money, and it, like with the Senate race, could ultimately decide the gubernatorial contest.
You know, the polls you mentioned are still very close. More than 50% in these polls, though, more than 50% of Ohioans still say, even as late as a month ago, say they don't know enough about John Kasich to make a decision. Are we getting late for that unknown factor to be that high?
Well, sometimes, you know, what you don't know can help you. Yeah. What you want to remember. I mean, if John Kasich was still a member of the Republican leadership in Congress, that would be to his detriment. But I kind of think that if we're going to Labor Day and still people don't know who John Kasich is, I would have thought that the money he spent on the campaign since he was basically it's been clear from the beginning that he's going to be the unopposed Republican nominee. It would be, you think that more people would know who Kasich is by now. After all, he was chairman of the House Budget Committee. He made an abortive run for president in 2000, which really didn't go anywhere, but he thought that he was strong enough to be considered as presidential timber. And the fact that so many people still don't know to this day who John Kasich is, that's not good news for the Republican Party. The bad news for the Democratic Party is that people do know who Ted Strickland is, and the economy is not doing that well. So the choice is, do you like what you have, or you like what you don't know? And that's the choice that'll be in November, too.
One observer told me last week that he said that people have already made up their mind on Ted Strickland, and all John Kasich has to do is just tell them or sell them that he's not the boogeyman.
I think that's true about a lot of things. I think, we keep talking about the fact that the economy might be turning around, and the Democrats would love to say that perhaps the economic numbers, there'll be more jobs created between now and November. But we saw, just go back to 1992 with the first President Bush. By the fall of 1992, and of course that was the famous It's the Economy Stupid campaign when Bush ultimately lost to Bill Clinton. In the fall of 92, the economy was getting better. Unemployment was coming down. More jobs were being created. But by the fall, by November, there was a mindset that even though the numbers may have been changing at the end, people knew for months that they were not happy. They didn't like the way the future looked. They didn't like the way the lives of their children and grandchildren. They were very pessimistic. So even though the numbers might be changing, the mindset was already there. And that could be big problems for the Democrats come November.
292-8513, if you'd like to join in our discussion with NPR's political editor Ken Rudin. Don, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, I hear this argument about the economy was Bush's fault, but I'm just curious with this housing bubble, and is it possible that this was set into motion prior to George W. and in the Clinton administration?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's a very good point, Don, because basically when you talk about the unsecured loans and the risky loans that Fannie and Freddie were doing, that was and the lack of regulation, that goes back to the Clinton years, clearly. So, I mean, just as Obama would love to talk about the inherited problems he got from Bush, the Republicans can say, wait a second, if you want to talk about inherited problems and the problems in the housing market and the jobs market and, the foreclosures, go back to the Clinton administration. Again, as Rob Portman said, as Mike said, quoting Rob Portman in the New York Times article, the question is whether we're going to do from here on out, who's going to be, who's going to be better for the future of Ohio and the country. But again, if you want to play the blame game, it doesn't start with Bush. If you want to talk about these issues, it certainly goes back to the Clinton administration. Absolutely.
Thanks for the call. 292-8513. If you have a question or a comment for NPR's political director, Ken Rudin, I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann Fisher on All Sides this morning on WOSU. Ken, you talk about the blame game. Of course, Ted Strickland is blaming Wall Street. And you mentioned John Kasich's ties to Lehman Brothers. He was a managing director. He claims he just ran a two-man office in Columbus, Ohio. I have a feeling if Lehman Brothers was doing gangbusters, his role would be elevated a bit in his bio. But is that going to work, the blaming Wall Street?
Well, it's a very unpopular term. We saw John Corzine, the governor of New Jersey, who came from Wall Street and Goldman Sachs and all that. Once upon a time, that helped John Corzine's career, political career, to a Senate victory and a gubernatorial victory in New Jersey. But by the time it became a dirty word, it obviously hurt. Democrats, of course, hope that Kasich's ties to Lehman Brothers, and as the new Strickland ad, as you say, a Strickland ad that just went up today, reminding voters of that tie. They hope that works too. But again, it's one of those things that, look, my record may not be great, but I want to focus on my opponent's record. And that's the issue there. And many candidates do that. It's not so much I deserve reelection. It's just that my opponent does not deserve to take my place in office, be it the governorship or the Senate or a congressional seat.
And Ted Strickland obviously trying to get those people who haven't made up their mind or don't know enough about John Kasich to think first that he's the former Wall Street executive, which isn't a great handle to have right now.
No, and of course, timing is everything. I mean, just as the Democrats are in such trouble in 2010, look how good they were, how fortunate they were in 2006. Now, this is kind of ironic to say fortunate because nobody wants to talk about a war, an unpopular war,
yes,
and rising taxes and rising food costs and unemployment being beneficial. But just as the Democrats took advantage of that in 2006 and to a lesser extent in 2008, especially in Ohio when they swept basically everything, almost everything in Ohio after decades or at least many terms of Republican rule, now the Republicans may come back only 4 years later.
Okay. Veronica, you have a question for Ken Rudin, NPR's political director, about John Kasich.
Yes, am I on the line?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Very nice program, Mike.
Thank you.
Yes, I don't really have a real well-honed question, if you will, but it's interesting that you're bringing up Kasich, and I always liked him, and then I noticed that your guest said that, I don't know if I heard it verbatim, but that he is not well-known. It's a bad sign at this point. I just wondered, with having that national program on Fox and having been a local boy for so long, maybe you could expand a little bit on Kasich, and I'd appreciate that, and I'll take my comment off air.
I was citing the polls, Veronica, that said that half
Thank
of voters
you.
Didn't know enough,
oh,
but
yeah.
But we'll get Ken's take on his recognizable name. Go ahead, Ken.
Well, look, just as Ted Strickland was just a member of Congress when he was elected governor in 2006, John Kasich not only was just a member of the House, although he was chairman of the Budget Committee, he hasn't run for office since 1998. And when he didn't become president in 2000, he retired from politics. That's 10 years out of the public eye. Now, yes, he does have the show on Fox. And matter of fact, I ran into him at the Republican convention in 2008 when he was talking. He talked to me about he was likely going to run for governor. And I said, boy, I told him I haven't even thought about him in so many years, and he smiled. But, you know, when you're out of office for a long time, people forget people forget what you did and what you stand for. But again, if the opponent has a record which is easily attacked, given a lack of manufacturing jobs and high unemployment, sometimes being out of the public eye is not the worst thing in the world.
I think also he was a congressman here in suburban Columbus, and I think
right.
Central Ohio knows him very well. I mean, he's written a couple of books, and I think he's still been around. And I think people at the State House and in Central Ohio have known he's around. But you get up to Northeast Ohio and Southwest Ohio and Northwest Ohio, and not necessarily. He was not a household name up there.
True, and that's why you have the money you need to spend to run statewide. And of course, if, as you say, that there's a much big difference politically between Central Ohio and the Southwest and Cincinnati and the Northeast in Cleveland. I remember when the big issue of the day, now it seems like such a silly issue, but the big issue was whether LeBron James should stay in Cleveland or not. And John Kasich said, look, you know, who cares? I mean, that's not going to save any jobs. That's not going to create any jobs. I mean, I love LeBron, but if he goes, that's not my problem. And Kasich got tons of criticism. And he said, this is insane to be criticized for this because, you know, I mean, there's so many more issues to talk about. So, perhaps maybe if he were running for mayor of Cleveland, he would be in big trouble, you know, bigger trouble than he is now.
All right. Do you see him? He ran for president once before, John Kasich did. Do you see him running for president if he wins the governor's race in Ohio?
I don't, only because, look, my predictions are, my original prediction, by the way, for vice president on the Republican side was Rob Portman. And then I decided to switch to Tim Pawlenty. So I'm over two in that thing. But I think there are so many new faces. You know, everybody talks about Paul Ryan of Wisconsin. You know, you're certainly 2008, you have the Huckabees and the Romneys, the folks, and perhaps Sarah Palin, although I question that. But a lot of the people who tried in 2008 will try again in 2012. And then if we're talking in 2016, I think, you know, first of all, it's very tough for a governor to run, to win, given all the problems at home. It's much easier to run as a senator because all basically you do is vote. Mm-hmm. You don't have to defend so many unpopular positions. And that's why so many governors are in such tough straits in 2010. Jim Doyle of Wisconsin is retiring because he couldn't run it because he probably couldn't win again. Had Jennifer Granholm been able to run again in Michigan, she probably would have lost given the status, the sense of unemployment and this situation with the economy. It's much tougher being a governor and defend your administration to run for president than it is for doing it from the congressional side.
And whoever wins the governor's race in Ohio is dealing with a huge potential budget deficit and all the stuff that comes with that, either deep, deep cuts or a combination of cuts and tax increases, and that's not going to help popularity here
But I'll tell you one thing it is very important for, it's redistricting. Gets elected in 2010 in California, in Florida, in Texas, in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, in Ohio, has a tremendous say in who, you know, their states gaining or losing congressional seats. And that, that is what's so important about the gubernatorial races, all 37 of them in 2010.
Our guest this hour, NPR political editor Ken Rudin on WOSU, All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. Speaking of congressional races, Ken, Mary Jo Kilroy, the congresswoman from Columbus, has been tabbed, one of the most vulnerable members of Congress. I think even if Barack Obama had popularity ratings in the 60s, she still would be vulnerable simply because of the demographics of that district. Is she on your list of most vulnerable Democrats? Do you have a list?
Oh, absolutely. Well, the list is, I figured I was going to wait until Labor Day to come out with the list, but you have Congress, is it Driehaus in Cincinnati?
Steve Driehaus, yes.
Steve Driehaus, he's having a rematch with the guy he unseated in 2008. And you also have the rematch with Steve Stivers.
With Mary Jo Kilroy.
But I mean, both Mary Jo Kilroy and Driehaus are in serious trouble. Just as the Republican brand was so unpopular in 2006, 2008, the Democratic brand seems to be equally unpopular, if not more so, in 2010. And a lot of Republicans are talking about gaining the 39 seats they need to make John Boehner Speaker of the House.
How does the Democrat like Steve Driehaus or Mary Jo Kilroy? What is the strategy they need to win re-election in this very anti-democratic year, if it turns out to be that way?
Well, of course, you know, it's a mirror opposite of what we saw in 2006. In 2006, Republicans said, oh, no, all politics are local. I'm just running on my record. I'm not worried about, you know, the Bush White House and the war in Iraq. I'm talking about what I've done for the district. Whereas Democrats back in 2006, 2008 said, this is a national election. This is a referendum on Bush and the war and the high gas prices and the food prices and things like that. The complete opposite now, Democrats would love to say, look, just like we saw in that special election in Pennsylvania, the Democratic candidate said, I'm not an Obama defender. I have nothing to do with President Obama. I'm here representing the people of Washington, Pennsylvania, not Washington, D.C. And whereas the Republicans, they really don't have much to say, or they don't need to say much, other than the last 2 years have been a disaster, and the Republicans, you know, it's time for a change. Now, some people, like John Boehner, obviously, in a speech this morning in Cleveland, said that Obama should fire Timothy Geithner, the whole economic team, and, you know, return to the way things used to be in the past. Democrats said, we don't think that things in the past were so much better than they are now. And so, again, it's going to be a thing. Do you distrust the president, but you want to go back to the Bush years? Or the Republicans say, we distrust the president, and it'll be better in 2010 and 2012 under Republican rule.
That's Ken Rudin. He's our political editor for NPR. We hear him each and every Wednesday on WOSU and Talk of the Nation 2 to 4 on WOSU. And also you can check out his blog at npr.org. The Political Junkie is the name of his blog. When we return, we'll talk about some of the big picture strategies. Will the party of no be enough to win some seats in the House and some governorships? We'll talk about that when All Sides continues on WOSU.
The next Fresh Air, Matt Richtel of the New York Times describes how digital technology is changing our lives and our brains. He says after 20 years of glorifying it, researchers are beginning to understand that this technology has its downside.
When you're constantly interrupted by email, you are experiencing stress. Stress equals stress hormones. Stress hormones take their toll on the brain.
Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. And you can hear more from WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher whenever you want with the online archive. Podcast new and archive shows from all the guests and topics. Podcast All Sides at WOSU.org/AllSides.
Support for WOSU comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment managers providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life at sherringtongroup.com.
72 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today, a high of 82, cloudy tonight, a low of 64. There's a slight chance of rain for Wednesday afternoon, otherwise partly cloudy and a high of 83. All Sides with Ann Fisher with guest host Mike Thompson continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Our guest, Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and the political junkie. That's the name of his blog. You can check it out on NPR.org. You can also listen to Ken Wednesdays on Talk of the Nation from 2 to 4 on WOSU 820. The Democrats keep saying the Republicans don't have a plan. They are simply the party of no. Ken, I was watching Fox News Sunday this week, and the Republican operative or strategist, I forget his name, said that, you know, with huge government spending and ballooning deficits and the health care overhaul, the party of no may just be the ticket. Would you agree?
Well, it's working so far. I mean, of course, November is still some 90 days away, November 2nd, some 90 days away, and things, you know, stranger things have happened, and things can change at the last minute. But just as Democrats did not have this amazing plan in 2006 to wrest away Congress from the Republicans. They just pointed out to the failures of the Republicans in the Bush White House on the war, as I say, on the war and the economy. And you know, that's pretty strong stuff. Republicans have been accused of being the party of no. And yes, they have fallen somewhat short in coming up with specifics of how they would do things differently regarding the stimulus package and the war in Afghanistan and things like that. But again, look, the campaigns are always notoriously known for either accept the incumbent party or throw them out, throw the bums out. You don't always have to have a plan. Not every opposition party had a contract with America, as Newt Gingrich and the Republicans did in 1994. And as that turned out, that fell on its face in many issues, like term limits, for all the talk about, you know, a change of a Democratic plan. So you don't have to be necessarily have to be more than a party of no. Now, of course, once you get into office and assume responsibility, and let's just say, for argument's sake, John Boehner becomes Speaker of the House, you're going to have to come up with something. But again, being the opposition with an unpopular president in the White House is not the worst position to be in.
The Democrats' message is, look, remember the financial collapse. I know it was a long time ago, and we were heading at the time, they claim, into a depression, but we stopped the slide. It could have been much worse. Will that message work? I mean, they're sort of campaigning against the negative almost. You know, it's bad. It still is bad, but it could have been a lot worse.
And that's tough to sell to you know, 10% or nearly 10% of the American public who's out of office, who, you know, have no strong prospects of getting, I said out of office, I mean out of work.
Yes.
And you know, with a lot of these people don't have strong prospects, certainly before November 2nd, of finding employment. So for the Democrats to say, well, even though things are really terrible, they could be even more terrible under Republican rule, that's not the kind of argument that I suspect works. So even, as I say, even if there is some improvement in job numbers between now and November, even if there's some manufacturing jobs that suddenly are created or some infusion of Washington money, there is a mindset in the country that things are not good. They were not good in 2006 and 2008, so we voted out the incumbent party. If they're not good in 2010, there's no change. We'll vote out the incumbent party again. Just the difference, of course, is this time the incumbent party has a D after its name instead of an R.
How much of an improvement in the economy do we have to see for for Democrats to really have a lot of hope. In Ohio, we've had the Strickland administration touts four successive months of very modest job growth, but job growth nonetheless. But still, the unemployment rate is at 10.3%, I believe.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything that – honestly, I don't think there's anything that could happen that will suddenly change people's minds saying, I think the economy is getting better. Perhaps – I mean, it's very possible that what happened to Bill Clinton in 1994 could happen to Barack Obama, that things – even though not comparing the economy because the economy was much better back then, but Bill Clinton had a lot of problems in 1994 and everything he tried to do to make it better didn't work, and his party suffered major, huge losses in the November 1994 elections. But come 2 years later, 1996, it wasn't even a close presidential contest with Bill Clinton and Bob Dole. Mm-hmm. Same with Ronald Reagan, 1982, the economy was bad. There was 11% unemployment. The Republicans were taking it on the chin. They lost some 26 or House seats or so, and the Republicans were really in dire straits. And then 2 years later, Reagan beat Walter Mondale with 49 states. So perhaps the Democratic Party, or at least the Obama White House, is saying we may have to sacrifice, we may lose a lot of seats in the House and Senate in November, but that does not necessarily affect our chances for reelection in 2012. And they'd be correct if they think that.
And they point out often that the ruling party loses seats in Congress in the midterm election following their presidential win.
The only time that didn't happen was after 2001 when the 9/11 attacks helped the Republicans in 2002.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Andrew, you're on the air with NPR political director Ken Rudin.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for taking my call. I am perplexed by President Obama not emphasizing paying down the debt to build the economy, make it stronger, and then create jobs. It just seems like I'm harkening back to Clinton. He had no debt. We had plenty of jobs. And then also, recently David Stockman came out against Reaganomics, cutting taxes at all costs, saying that if we pay down the debt, that would help a lot. It just seems like his message is not out there, or that message isn't out there. I just wonder what you thought of that.
Well, I don't think thanks for the question, Andrew. I don't think that the Obama presidency or the White House has been thinking about paying down the debt from the outset. I think their feeling was that there are so many things that need government spending. We saw that with the stimulus package. We saw that with the bailouts of the banks and the auto companies. And I think the last thing on their mind right now is getting rid of the deficit. More is just to jumpstart the economy. It's pretty late to jumpstart the economy. And perhaps they say that ultimately, in the end, there will be savings. But with a massive health care plan, with a massive stimulus program, the debt, for all the deficit that Republicans railed about and did nothing about during the Bush years, it's gotten far more significant in the Obama years, and it's not going to likely to improve anytime soon.
Thanks for the call, Andrew, 292-8513. About 11 minutes left if you want to jump on. We're speaking with Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and host of the blog Political Junkie. The mosque controversy, Ken, what do you make of that?
Well,
the New York mosque.
Of course, it's not a mosque, and it's not at Ground Zero. Mm-hmm. But other than that, the reporting of that is completely accurate. It's an Islamic center mm-hmm. that includes a place for prayer, two blocks from Lower Manhattan, where the World Trade Center went down. And this has become a political football, a real political football. Perhaps President Obama didn't need to jump in the way he did and then seemingly backtrack the next day. We said, well, I'm not really endorsing this so-called mosque. I am saying that there should be freedom of religion. Well, nobody questions whether it's freedom of religion or not. The question is whether this should be a political football. And basically, not only have the Republicans been given a gift, even though it is unfortunate in many ways, because it just some of the base instincts of the American people seem to be kind of less tolerant than many people would like. But it's not so much the Republicans who are taking advantage of this, it's the Democrats are running away from it as well. Mm-hmm. When you have the Senate Majority Leader, yeah. Harry Reid, saying, well, we shouldn't have this there, and I think they should move it, you basically, one, give the Republicans cover, and you undercut a lot of the Democrats, saying, now I have to choose between Harry Reid and President Obama. So the Democrats seem to be on the disadvantage on this issue. And look, let's be honest here. If the President of the United States was not Barack Hussein Obama, mm-hmm. perhaps this wouldn't be the kind of issue it became. If this were George W. Bush, perhaps, you know, you wouldn't see the vitriol you see right now. But look, 9/11 mm-hmm. still, you know, is in many people's eyes is still what everybody thinks about politically. And even if this mosque has nothing to do, this so-called mosque has nothing to do with, look, here's the thing that bothers me about this. I'm trying to get my thoughts out of this. When Newt Gingrich says it's like putting a Nazi shrine at Auschwitz or something like that, I mean, that's basically what he's doing, is saying that Muslims and Nazis are the same. He's equating the two. And that's where what President Bush desperately did not want to happen. He said, look, there are terrorists and there's the religion of Islam, and they are not the same thing. It's being blurred now.
Why can't Democrats, Harry Reid, Barack, I know Harry Reid faces a tough reelection fight, but couldn't they gain some mileage by just standing up and saying, you know what? This belongs here. It should be here. We have this freedom of religion. Not all Muslims are terrorists, and people are wrong to equate them with Nazis. Why can't they just stand up and take a stand?
Because three words, profiles and courage. And the fact that Sharon Angle, the Republican nominee for the Senate in Nevada, is so discredited and so ridiculed as an extremist by so many people, and the fact that it's still a dead even race shows that for all the faults Sharon Angle has as a candidate, there are a lot of people who just don't like Harry Reid. And you'd think that as a leader of a party, an embattled leader of a party, but as a leader of the party in the Senate, there should be some kind of profile and courage. I'm not saying that he should have this view or that view, but to run away from an issue because of fearing how it will affect his reelection is just not the kind of leadership Democrats should get. But both parties should have more leadership, and they're not getting it.
292-8513. Just a couple of minutes left if you want to jump on the phone with NPR's political director Ken Rudin. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann Fisher on All Sides here on WOSU. It's already dropped way off the radar, the BP oil spill. Any political implications of the way the Obama administration handled that, or is that going to be long gone and forgotten by November?
There used to be a routine on Saturday Night Live called short attention span theater, where you would just, you know, they talk about something and it'll be gone 5 minutes later. We seem to make this big deal. Remember, not only was it the BP oil spill and the administration's slow response to it, but then you had these congressmen like from Texas who said that BP is, you know, they're being exorbitantly harassed by the government. And that was going to be the Democratic issue. We just move on to things, from things to things to things, at the drop of a hat, and BP is no longer a big issue. For a while, it seems to have gotten Charlie Crist back in the ballgame in Florida, because while he was on the defensive for so many months, his leadership in the wake of the BP spill, the fact mm-hmm. that he was on TV every time, seemed to have helped his political chances for November.
And correct me if I'm wrong, he's been a long-time opponent to offshore drilling off of Florida.
He was, but when he was in a tough primary with Marco Rubio, he suddenly came out for it, and then after the BP spill and after he left the Republican Party, he said, oh, no, I'm definitely against it. But look, right before the spill, President Obama, trying to get Republican votes for the climate bill, said, well, maybe we should have more drilling.
It's perfectly safe.
Perfectly safe, and that turned out to be less than accurate.
So it's safe to say that this current egg contamination recall will be a blip as well, and won't lead to massive calls for more regulation of the farm industry?
Well, you know, I haven't heard that become a political issue yet, but of course, you know, if the eggs came from a mosque, a Muslim mosque, then you knew that, you know, this would be real high stuff. And one more thing to talk about, the fact that everybody talks about everything that Sarah Palin does and breathes and thinks, and basically Sarah Palin, all she does, she writes a sentence on Twitter or she writes a little paragraph on Facebook, and everybody goes ballistic saying, well, Sarah Palin has a stake in this. And it's just so fascinating to watch how people respond to her when all she is really, I mean, she appears on Fox, mm-hmm. but everything else is really these endorsements, these putting her reputation at stake. Really, all they are Twitter tweets and Facebook entries, and that's it. And it's just remarkable that we spend so much time on it.
Has there ever been another personality in politics you can compare to Sarah Palin in your memory?
Well, I mean, you know, Ross Perot had that kind of thing. You know, he had the anger and he had the outrage. And Sarah Palin, look, I think for a short time, did help the Republican Party in 2008 because McCain didn't seem to be exciting the base. But ultimately, she just seems uncurious, if that's a word. And well, you know, she makes up words, so I can make up words too, I guess. But you know, she just, unlike the Huckabees and the Polentes and the Romneys, the people are out or giving out, you know, strong positions and giving speeches. Sarah, I'm not convinced that Sarah Palin is looking at 2012 as she is. She just is a combination of entertainer and activist. But I'm not convinced she's a presidential candidate.
A couple of things popped up last week when President Obama was visiting Ohio, and Mary Jo Kilroy mentioned it. I think it was some other Democrats here in Ohio mentioned it, that Republicans want to privatize Social Security. Was that just a trial balloon that floated up last week, or is that something that Democrats may try to hang their head on in the last couple of months?
Well, they've done it before. I mean, the Democrats have used that issue before. It helped as far back as 1982 when there was one or two or three or ten Republicans who said that, you know, we have to change the retirement age or we should have to have more privatization. And whenever a Republican does that, it gives the Democrats such an opening, an opportunity to say, boy, this is exactly what we need. So here we are, the Democrats are talking about the Republicans privatizing Social Security, seniors beware, and then the mosque issue comes along, and then they just get flummoxed and they say, mm-hmm. Oh my God, my goodness, we had something in our hands and we let it fritter away. But that is a typical Democratic ploy with some justification, saying that Republicans are not the friends of Social Security as the Democrats are. It's an issue that did work in 1982. It did not work in 2000 when they used it against Bush, did not use it in 2004 when they used it against Bush again. Remains to be seen whether that'll be a key issue in 2010.
Why are Republicans better at staying on message than Democrats? It seems that way anyway. Maybe you disagree. I don't know.
Well, look, I think it's much easier being in the opposition than it is being mm-hmm. on the defensive. And so Newt Gingrich was great when he was an opposition leader before 1994. But once he became Speaker of the House, then there was the Democrats who were on message saying that they would, you know, roll back the 20th century, roll back the Bill of Rights, whatever. I think once you're on the outside hoping to come back, it's easier to be with a strong all-unit. Look, to watch the Republicans vote in lockstep on issues like the health care and Supreme Court nominees and things like that is just remarkable discipline. Republicans do have it more than the Democrats. They always will have it more than the Democrats, but it's so much easier to do it when you're in the opposition.
We'll end with an email from Carol. She wants to know, if Republicans get control of Congress, or even if they only gain just a few seats but still remain in the minority, will anything get done in Washington after this election?
Let me think for a second. No. No, it's going to be even worse.
I was hoping you'd say yes.
Well, the fact is Barack Obama had 60 Senate seats for a short time and couldn't get it. It took him forever to get a health care bill. We think that the Democrats may have like maybe 53, 52 Senate seats in the next Senate, if that much, and much fewer House seats as well. If the Democrats couldn't get their agenda passed, although they did accomplish a lot, but to get most of their agenda done with these numbers, it's going to be much uglier in 2011, 2012 with far fewer numbers.
So you
and
don't...
By the way, Mike, do you know that we're going to see you in Columbus on October 13th?
Oh, that's right. Yes, you'll
Talk
be
the
here.
Nation is coming. We're going to be there.
That'll
the
be great.
The Junkie and the whole crew coming to Columbus October 13th.
We are looking forward to it. Always a great time. I was hoping you were going to tell me there was a great spirit of bipartisanship was going to well up after November and we get everything taken care of.
But Mike, do they have drug testing at WOSU? Not going to happen.
Need another cup of coffee. Thanks very much. Ken Rudin, political editor at NPR. You can read his blog, Political Junkie, and hear him every Wednesday on Talk of the Nation here on WOSU. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann Fisher. This is listener supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.